Good afternoon and welcome to Atlas Wealth Management's Ask an Expert webinar. Previously, we held a webinar on the top 10 problems that US expats face with tax. Today, we're proud to have Darko Zigic online with us from Arena Financial Solutions. We're going to talk about the top problems that expats face with insurance. And to be honest with you, this is probably not one of the most exciting things that we talk about in expat land. Countries you're moving to, schools you're going to, where you're going to live, that ranks up at the top end. Financial planning and insurance is way down the bottom. But like anything with this space, it's little things done right at the beginning that gives you the best results when you don't anticipate an event happening. So, Darko, welcome on board, mate.
Thank you once again.
No, my pleasure. And let's just start sharing our screens here. Okay. And, okay, can you guys see the screen there?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, fantastic. So, as I said, we're running through the top 10 problems Australian expats experience with insurance. A little bit of housekeeping, like any financial services presentation, webinar, we must impress upon all the listeners and the viewers that the information we talk about here today is general in nature and is not to be deemed as personal advice. Atlas Wealth Management nor Robina Financial Solutions has been sued in the past nor plans to get sued in the future for any misrepresentation. So please ensure that you do speak to a specialist about any of these situations. Any of the times that myself, James or Darko is talking about any sort of case studies or examples, these are examples. They are not to be deemed as specific personal advice. So please ensure that you read that. Obviously, we're recording the webinar, so if you do suffer from insomnia, I encourage you to read that. You'll be asleep in 5 minutes. Who is Atlas Wealth Management? We're the leading provider of Australian expat financial advice and won multiple domestic and international awards for this service we provide to Australian expats overseas. We've had the privilege of working with clients in over 28 countries, and this is all we do. You know, we every day in, day out, we live and breathe expat advice. And all of our financial advisors are degree qualified with numerous postgraduate certifications. Thanks to this work we do, we are the true global financial advisors to Australian expats. Who is Darko and who is Robina Financial Solutions? Darko joined Robina Financial Solutions in May 2012 and has a master's in financial planning. Darko was a finalist in the 2017 IFA Excellence Awards for Risk Advisor of the Year category. Darko and the team have been providing insurance advice to Atlas Wealth Management clients since 2016, and he's an authorised representative of Australian Advice Network, PTY LTD.
Brett, we should also mention that Darko was also nominated last year as well, 2018, for the IFA Awards.
He certainly was. I'm glad you picked that up there, James. Thanks very much for reminding me there.
I was there. We were there. We were looking at him. We were voting for him and hoping he was going to get up. So just wanted to throw that in there. 2 years running. So life in this year, third year running as well.
Third year and he's going to get the gong this year.
That's right.
Fantastic. Okay, well, I'll just hand it over now to James, who is going to run through the seminar and start talking about the key points.
Sounds good, Brett. Thanks for that. So first point, insurance inside of superannuation. So I suppose a general inquiry that we often get is, I already have insurance cover within my super fund. Is it still valid with me heading overseas permanently? And Darko, you probably come across this one quite regularly. And what are your thoughts on that? What's your general guidance regarding super insurance validity when heading overseas permanently?
Absolutely. I come across this quite a fair bit. And the main issue that I see is people that may have already left and stationed overseas and not realise that the insurance policy is invalid as soon as they become a non-resident. Very few times people, as you mentioned previously, the excitement of going overseas is there, and looking at your financial planning or your insurances especially is the last thing on your mind. So unfortunately, people can go overseas expecting that they still have cover, as they may have seen a statement from the previous year stating that they have X amount of cover in place. Now, the hard part is actually when we speak to these clients and say, well, unfortunately, due to the trustees of your superannuation fund, they've decided that because you're a non-resident for tax purposes, your insurance contract is invalid anymore.
Yep.
And the worst thing that can happen is in the event of a claim and not knowing this, and this is a scary part that we do face on a daily basis, where we do find clients go, look, I should still have a cover in place. Why was I told this when I left?
Yeah, so okay.
Is always looking at based on, do you have an insurance cover in place and is it valid? That is the most true question that we can ask for them.
And I think I often come across clients that say, yes, you know, my super fund knows I'm overseas because I've updated my address, but honestly, it means nothing, to be honest. You know, even though you've updated your address, that you're overseas, you're in Thailand, Singapore, US, wherever it might be, that's automatically not going to send a notification to the super fund to contact you and say, listen, you're overseas, your insurance is now invalid. It's something that does fall on the actual member of that super fund. Just, I mean, talking about insurances, what kind of insurances are commonly held within our super that we pay for?
The most common ones that I tend to see is life and total and permanent disablement. Some insurance companies with superannuation do also provide some income protection. So it does really depend on the superannuation fund themselves and what they do provide to their members on that case. But also to your previous point, you're absolutely right. Even when you change your address details, if you haven't notified the superannuation fund, they once again will think of yourself as still an Australian resident. And we've seen this previously with a superannuation provider that the only way they could continue your insurance policies is to actually write to the trustees and get the trustees' permission to do so. So one of those things that you don't expect to do, especially if you've spoken to someone on the phone and they haven't provided you with this information.
Yep, okay. And I mean, well, you probably briefly touched on it just then, but what is the non-resident exclusion? So, I mean, I'm assuming that's coming down to tax residency and the insurance provider.
Correct. So a large superannuation fund, unfortunately, has it within their policy for a member to have an insurance policy, they have to be a resident of Australia. Now, majority of times I see with expats, they're a non-resident for tax purposes. So I can see that benefit, but unfortunately, by making that decision, they've ultimately cancelled their insurance policy without knowing.
Yeah, exactly right. And I mean, it's pretty common that expats are non-residents because they don't want their overseas income being taxed and they might leave a few things here. And I suppose, yeah, lastly, the dot point is pretty crucial. Are all super funds the same?
Ooh, no, unfortunately. The reason why I say that, every superannuation fund can, once again, coming from an insurance point of view, decide on what type of cover they do want to provide to their clients from a default point of view. And also, they can also change the definitions. One company in particular has changed their total and permanent disability definitions to, rather than receiving one lump sum payment, to get receive a payment over a period of 5 to 6 years. So that is can impact a person's livelihood, especially if they're having to receive a once-off figure, but unfortunately have to go through a claim every 6 years to receive a proportion of it.
Ah, okay, I see. Yeah, okay, so it's paid periodically, but you still need to go through the same claim process over and over again.
Unfortunately, the decision that they've made, look, I believe that is a terrible decision. Having to help many clients go through a total and permanent disability claim, it does put a lot of stress on their lives, and unfortunately you're telling them that they need to go through this process over the next 5-6 years is really heartbreaking.
Yeah, absolutely, especially when it's for the rest of their life. So no, I can definitely understand and appreciate that. All right, we'll move on to point two, and you know, we're going to be looking now at just how much cover. So I already have cover and I think it's enough, so I suppose we know we were talking now about the three types of cover within superannuation. There's obviously some others outside of super, but how do we know what's enough? Because we know that our super funds automatically load an amount on there. How do they know what to load on as well? So how much is enough, Darko?
That's a really interesting question. Every person is different. So what we tend to do is review what their needs are. And what we typically see is, yes, they might have some cover within their superannuation fund, but with a default cover, that actually reduces as you get older. So what you tend to see is you may have a policy starting off, as an example, at $500,000, and in a short period of time, that might reduce down to $300,000. The impacts of that are you may have, once again, extended your family, you may have taken on more debt. All these different factors can really put pressure on the amounts of cover that you do have in place. And also, how much is enough? It really depends on being an expat. Are you expecting to stay overseas in the event of a sickness or disablement, or are you planning to come back into Australia? If you are coming back into Australia, are you buying a property outright, or are you going into your old rental property or your principal place of residence? All these questions need to be answered before you can actually work out what is enough cover, if that makes sense.
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, there's no sort of blanket type of cover amount. There's no particular formula that you use. It's case by case, as we all know. I think you briefly just touched base then on declining group cover. You said, you know, starting off at 500,000, then it goes down. So what is declining group cover?
So group cover is basically where superannuation providers for their members will say you have a default benefit. This default benefit you don't have to apply for. So as an example, they might provide you with $500,000 worth of life cover and $300,000 worth of total and permanent savings cover. This is a benefit that they provide to the members, and for a client's point of view, it's great because they don't have to go through the underwriting process, and it's very simple for a person to select, yes, I want to be a part of that program. The issue with that program is because of default cover, it is based on your age as well as the units that you might hold within that that time frame. As you get older, the units still might represent, as an example, one unit might be 100,000, you might have five units, but in 3, 4, 5 years' time, that one unit might only be worth 50,000. So straight away, you're reducing the amount of cover, but you still have the same amount of units. So what you have to be wary of is it true fixed level of cover, or is it default cover that's reducing?
Okay. That's a crucial point. And I suppose it would come down to, you know, how often you even look at your cover and whether you're paying attention to it. And I mean, that's on to the next point. I mean, I suppose how often should someone, an expat or an individual, review their actual insurance? How often should they check in and make sure it's still providing that good level of cover, you know, suitable for their individual circumstances?
We tend to review our clients every year. The reason why is insurance should be based on time and need. So as an example, 5, 10 years ago, you may have had a lot more cover because you had a lot more debt. Your kids might have been younger and so forth. And unfortunately, if you haven't reviewed this, your policy may have stayed at the same level or increased with CPI. What we tend to do is see, is that cover still relevant for your needs? So as an example, you might have had a debt of $500,000 and you've been able to pay off that debt, and you still have cover to protect that debt that you don't have. So unfortunately, you're paying for premiums that you don't need. So that's the whole concept about reviewing your insurance policy. So once again, we tend to do that every year with our clients just to make sure it's still valid for their reasoning.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, when it comes to reviewing our insurance, obviously yearly is crucial, but I guess also, like you just mentioned, you know, significant life events, paying out a mortgage, debt being reduced, taking on more debt, these things we need to make sure they're accounted for.
Great.
That's good. Okay, well, we'll move over to point three. So new superannuation opt-in requirements. Now, I think these came out, I believe, last year. I think there was an email that was sent out, something regarding the voluntary insurance I think it was I'm blanking at the moment, but I suppose how does the new opt-in requirements for life insurance inside of superannuation affect me? So how does that all get incorporated?
So when they first proposed, so when the government first proposed the new changes to opt-in requirements within life insurance, it was really targeted at people age under 25. But when you actually review the actual proposal, it actually had no age limit on there or age barrier. So as an example, this could affect a person at age 50, 60 years old, especially if they have a low superannuation balance. The main key points that they were looking at is, first off, small superannuation balance, so as an example, below $6,000, and also if you don't have any contributions going into your superannuation fund. Now, this will impact expats, especially if it's kept in the same form. The reason why, you might have an expat with two superannuation funds, as an example. The first one might be just to hold insurance benefits, and the second one is really where they're investing with their superannuation fund. Now, the issue with that is the initial superannuation fund, it might have a small account balance with nothing going in other than maybe a top-up of superannuation every year or every 2 years just to make sure that there's enough premiums, funds to cover the premiums. Now, the issue with this is, under the new opt-in situation, is if you do not have contributions going through your number one superannuation fund, your insurance fund, that means that your insurance policy may be closed off without you opting in. So most people won't be aware of this. Unfortunately, the media has really presented it more as people under age 25, when realistically it can affect anyone. We're still waiting to see what it's what it comes out in its true form. It's still going through Senate trying to get approved. But once again, may actually halter a lot of people due to the opt-in scenario.
So it's still coming about now. It's still coming to fruition, but it's not something which is, I suppose, legislation yet. I mean, it's a scary piece. It is a scary piece of legislation. You're spot on in terms of a lot of people that assume they have insurance in a few years' time won't have that insurance, which was valid with overseas residency, which is quite common. You already mentioned, I mean, based on outlining that draft piece of legislation, what do I need to ensure coverage is maintained? And I'm assuming that's some sort of ongoing contributions every 12 months to keep it happy, keep it funded. If it's a case where, I know it's still at draft stage, if the account is under 6,000, but we're still contributing, say, $500 or $1,000, you know, per annum, is that still, you know, ticking the relevant box to make sure it's going to maintain being active?
That's a really interesting question. The reason why I say that, the government hasn't actually proposed what the actual contribution limit should be. We're still questioning, is it the, as an example, the premiums, or is it a certain number? We don't know yet. That's the honest answer. It's still going through. We still need to see how that comes out in its true form. But unfortunately, we don't know at this stage. So how will it be maintained? We'll find out. As soon as we find out, we'll let you know.
Yeah, see how it comes out in the wash. No, that's fair enough. All right, we'll move on to point number four. So cover as an expat. So when I'm an expat, when I'm living overseas, you know, can I apply for insurance cover back in Australia?
So there's a few definitely criteria when you're trying to apply for insurance while you're an expat. The first off, what they look at, or insurance companies-wise, realistically, there's only three insurance companies that are comfortable with expat. Let's start off there. From those three, they look at its few criteria. First off, which country are you living in? And how does that reflect on the DFAT rating? So as an example, if you have a country that is classified as high risk, unfortunately, straight away, they won't be able to provide you with insurance cover. The second area is your intentions to come back home, so back to Australia. So as an example, what they look at is usually within 7 years. If you're coming back within 7 years, then they're happy to look at providing cover. Within that area, then they also look at your occupation. What occupation do you have? What are the risks associated with that? And finally, your assets back home in Australia. So you might have intentions to come back to Australia, but you have no assets here, therefore it might be very likely that you might stay in the country that you're living in at that situation and time. So that's what we're looking to. So first off, can we apply for cover while overseas? Yes, depending on those variables, first of all.
Okay, no, that absolutely makes sense. And I suppose, you know, the last dot point we mentioned here is, you know, what are the key points that will determine if I can or can't obtain cover? You mentioned, obviously, there needs to be some sort of intention of returning within that 7-year block. What about if I've already been overseas for a period? Is there generally a cut-off time frame where that insurance provider might say, listen, you've been overseas for 15 years, there's too much underlying that might have happened, therefore we're not comfortable?
Correct. So realistically, anyone over the period of 7 to 10 years at the absolute max would be a no. You wouldn't be able to apply for cover.
Yep, no, that's fair enough. Need to ask because I know there'd be, I mean, thousands of expats out there wanting to know that exact question, just because it is a common inquiry that I get. But flicking over now to point number five, so, you know, what is available to expats? So I suppose generally speaking, you know, what insurance products are available to Australian expats? You know, probably also referring to, you know, the types of covers that expats can actually apply for.
So basically coming from the insurance landscape regarding insurances, you've got two structured products. First off, you have lump sum. So lump sum consists of life cover. So if you've passed away or if you've got 24 months where you're terminally ill and will pass away during that period of time, you've got total and permanent disablement, which is, once again, let's say you're driving along, someone smashes into you, you're paralysed and unable to work in either any or own occupation. And then finally, from your lump sum products is trauma cover, or could be called critical illness. A trauma cover realistically is there for a severe illness such as cancer, heart attack, stroke, Parkinson's, the list goes on. So those are your main lump sum covers, and majority of the times the insurance companies are very comfortable providing those covers compared to a monthly income stream. The monthly income stream is classified as your income protection, and that can be definitely quite harder to apply for a policy. So once again, the insurance policies or products are definitely there for expats. It just really depends on what we're trying to provide, as in what cover areas that we're trying to look after, and also how can we structure it going forward as well.
With the income protection cover, that's I know I see a lot of the time on client superannuation statements, that's just the same as salary continuance, isn't it?
Absolutely correct.
Yeah. And I suppose, absolutely. Is the income protection hard to sometimes achieve because you've also got to factor in exchange rates and other things and, you know, relevant tax or applicable tax rates and all these other things?
Correct, absolutely. So when you actually look at your actual income protection policy, it has a lot of different factors. If we have a look at salary continuance within your superannuation fund, it's typically a basic product that only covers a duties-based definition. So what that means is it can be hard to claim on, and then if we put the expert on top of that, based on your current income stream or, once again, your tax, that could also come with some issues. Versus, yeah, even if we look at an income protection policy, it really needs to be tailored to your specific needs. So as an example, if you're an expat, working in Dubai, and you may not be paying tax in that capacity, we still need to be able to provide saying that, yes, you're generating this much worth of earnings, and this is the amount of cover that we're applying for. So that's the recommendation. It's always reviewing your types of cover and how they actually assist you in the event of a claim.
Okay, and so I suppose it is achievable, income protection, but again, case by case, obviously, like you said, depending on the country that you're in. If you're in a DFAT 5 country like Iraq or Syria or those other countries, very difficult. That absolutely makes sense. Okay, no, that's quite clear. I'll move on to point 6 now, so just rolling that over.
Just before we go to the next one, Darko, just thought it's a good opportunity. Do you want to explain to the viewers the difference between group cover and retail cover?
Absolutely. So group cover, once again, is the default cover that you usually have within your superannuation fund. How group cover works is you might have members of, say, 1,000 people, and they'll provide insurance covers to all those people without reviewing their individual circumstances. So as an example, you might have a person that is absolutely fit, triathlete, knows what they're doing, and once again, is absolutely fine with their health. And unfortunately, you might also have another person in part of that member that has had heart issues, has had a heart attack and so forth. Because of that, they look at everyone in that group and apply a premium based on a percentage of those people will get sick and a percentage of those people will be quite healthy. So they try to offset those costing. The issue with that is, once again, it is a very basic policy. So what I mean by basic policy is, let's pick on TPD. Under a TPD definition under a group policy, it's any occupation. So any occupation that you're qualified or could work in, that's based on your previous work history. So previously, I'll pick on myself, don't think of me as a geek too much. I used to be a systems engineer, so in IT, and now in financial planning for quite a long time. But if we have to look back into my previous experience based on IT, could I have an accident that could stop me from doing my current role in financial planning and allow me to work in IT work? Well, there could be cases of that, definitely. So unfortunately, when we're looking at group cover, it is basic. It has its purpose, but isn't great for everyone. What I tend to find is more own occupation. If we have a look at the TPD, own occupation covers your current own occupation that you're working in, especially if you're a high-skilled expat. I truly believe that this is a better policy for yourself.
And you know, I think the key distinction as well too is with retail cover, it is underwritten at time of policy, whereas Absolutely. Group cover is underwritten at time of claim. So just because you've been paying premiums for 5 years and then you go a lodge a claim doesn't mean you're automatically accepted, as opposed to with a retail policy, as soon as the insurer accepts your policy, you know, 5 years later, you can claim on it and you'll have some degree of certainty that they'll pay out the claim.
Correct. You're absolutely correct there. The issue with, once again, as an example, real insurances and so forth, they might pick up the phone and try to apply for cover. Yes, they might give you cover over the phone. Here we go, here's $1 million worth of cover. But the issue is they don't actually underwrite your file. So they don't understand your health history. So the issue with that is, in the event of a claim, they might say, well, you didn't disclose to us that you had a health issue 5 years ago, so therefore we're cancelling your claim. Versus a retail policy, similar to going through a home loan, where they need to assess your individual case and can they provide you with that contract. If they can provide you with that contract, you have more certainty at claim time.
Okay, no, fantastic. Thanks for covering that off. We'll just roll across to the next one now, James.
Yep. So moving on to number six. So, you know, touching base on worldwide cover and whether it's attainable. So if I purchase Australian insurance, does it provide cover worldwide? So, I mean, going back to applying to a local insurance provider and whether it's going to be valid overseas.
Absolutely. That's a really interesting question. The reason why I say that is it actually depends on the actual insurance company. James, from one of your clients just recently, we found out that even though they're applying for insurance cover, they're not valid based on themselves being a non-resident. So once again, it really depends on, A, is your insurance policy tailored to yourself being an overseas expat? Now, majority of times you'll see that most insurance companies will provide you with worldwide cover, but that's based on if you're on a holiday versus if you're going to move and live overseas. So once again, it's on a case-by-case basis. Even though they might say it is worldwide cover, it usually is only for a short duration of time. So if you have any concerns, once again, contact us and we can also have a look at that. But to answer that question, it is on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a really interesting point you just make about worldwide cover, because I've read too many PDSs, you know, insurance PDSs for superannuation accounts, and there's always a worldwide cover carve-out saying, yes, 24/7 worldwide cover. But what does that actually mean? And then once you actually do the relevant calls, the reviews, whatever, it's exactly how you just put it, a short secondment or a holiday, and that's it, not permanent relocating. You briefly just mentioned in what countries or regions would the cover not be valid. I think, you answered that before, DFAT 5 countries, you know, war-torn countries where obviously the risk is just too great. So that makes sense. I'll move on to point seven now. Employer cover. Okay, so cover across this a little bit actually with a lot of US clients. So my employer is providing me with cover, so should I worry? So probably regarding the type of different covers that your different worldwide employers actually provide.
So your worldwide employers typically will provide life, TPD, and sometimes they'll include an income protection contract or a salary continuance contract. That contract's typically on a 90-day waiting period for a two-year benefit. So once again, short time frame. And once again, the benefits of claiming, they're on the group policy, so they're not too bad. I have no issues with that. The issue that I see typically is around visa requirements. So as an example, within the US, you might be on long-term claim, so anything above realistically 6 months is classified as a long-term claim. Now, the question is, in the event you're unable to work in the US, can you still hold up that working visa? If it's a no, then legally the insurance contracts can simply say, well, no, you're not a part of that company based overseas anymore, therefore we're cancelling your insurance contract. So that was quite an interesting experience that we had with a couple of, with quite a fair few US expats. After reading the reviewing the PDSs and understanding their insurance policies, we could definitely see that issue of, once again, how would the US government look at their policy if they weren't able to work as in the US? So the big area is, how would the visa restrictions really impact your policy? So even though you might have a policy in place that really is covering your needs, unfortunately, it might be non-valid based on your visa.
Okay, well, I actually wasn't aware of that, so that's huge. I can imagine it would actually impact a lot of US-based Aussie expats, visa restrictions. You addressed that last question, so we'll move on to point eight about claim handling. Let's run through, I suppose, a bit of a scenario, hypothetical. I'm an engineer, I use my hands daily. I break my hand and I can no longer use my hand for work just for about, 12 weeks because it's got to heal. What happens in the event I need to lodge a claim? What's the process?
Okay. So the reason why I wanted to talk about this slide is especially understanding how to claim. A lot of people do have an insurance policy, but once again, hopefully they don't ever need to claim, but if they do, they need to understand the process. Now, first of all, what will happen is you need to either contact the insurance company or the advisor associated onto that policy. Now, that person or the company will then provide you with claims forms. Now, part of those claim forms, there'll be three sets of claims forms, two to three. First of all, it's what happened to yourself. So as an example, you broke your hand. How did it happen? Have you ever had injuries to your hand previously? Are you unable to work ever during the period of time, or are you completely unable to work, and so forth? The second phase is actually, or documentation that you need to provide is to your specialist. So James, as an example, you might need to see a surgeon. That surgeon needs to complete a form. Now, what we typically see is many surgeons or many doctors are quite busy, so it can take them a very long time for the form to be completed and then sent back to the actual insurer or the advisor. So my recommendation is also, when you actually give the forms to your doctor, is to actually say to them, I need these forms back as soon as possible. Can you please help me out on this basis? The reason why is you don't want to be on claim not knowing if it's been approved or declined and not knowing that the actual doctor hasn't submitted that last form for them to sign off on it. So what's best practice when it comes to lodging an insurance claim is understanding the documents that you have. Unfortunately, you might receive some documents if you're overseas from the insurer and you're not sure how to complete them. This is typically what we find, or typically what we hear is we've received some documents, it's jargon, we don't know what it is, and we don't know how to go for it going forwards. So my recommendation is always you really want to speak to the doctor, first of all, and ask them for their help or their assistance, fill in their claim documents. And for your own documents, if there is an advisor attached, get them to help you with the claims forms, as that's what they're there for.
Okay. Yeah, and I mean, would it be often the case where if I've got insurance within a super fund, they tell me it's valid, but one of their conditions might be that for me to be assessed, I actually need to return to Australia? Is that something quite common?
Correct, absolutely. Usually there is an expat clause where it's within the first 3 months, you do need to come back to Australia to have your case reviewed by an Australian assessor or an Australian doctor. That's what we typically see. That's also on the basis that you can return. So as an example, you might be in a coma, stuck in hospital. The insurance companies typically will understand that. However, there is some insurance companies that are default policies that might say, look, we will stop payments after 3 months until you can come back to Australia. So that's something to be aware of as well. So typically, yes, there will be an expat clause. However, majority of times, insurance companies can be flexible, depending on the actual insurer as well.
Okay, no, that's clear. Okay, well, we'll move on to number 9 because you addressed best practice quite clearly there. And I mean, binding nominations, do you have a binding death benefit nomination in place? So I suppose, what is a binding nomination with regards to insurance and superannuation?
Okay, so regarding a binding nomination is to leave your benefits to your beneficiary. Now, there's two different ways of nominating a person. There's a non-binding and a binding. Non-binding basically means I wish for my funds to go, let's say, to my wife, and that's what I want to see happen. Unfortunately, non-binding is more so that wish factor. So in the event the trustees could say, look, part of those benefits should go to your kids. So we're going to push the money over to your kids and your wife only gets 60% as an example. They can elect to have that in place versus a binding nomination basically means that I want my money to go to my beneficiary. So once again, the whole proceeds will go to Kayla, my wife, on that basis.
So, and I suppose, Darko, you keep going.
The difference between a non-binding and a binding is, once again, it needs to be witnessed by two independent people. Now, the issue that we tend to see is, as an example, I want to leave my money to Kayla and I'll sign off on that form. Kayla will sign off on that form. Now, straight away, that is invalid. So even though you've done the right steps, because you haven't got it witnessed correctly, it's not valid in place.
Okay. And I mean, one other item that I see is a legal representative where people nominate a legal representative. So what is that?
A legal representative could be your estate or your will. So as an example, you might have a situation where you don't know who you want to nominate as your beneficiary. So what you could do is say my legal representative, which then reverts to the will. The will then determines how you structured your actual insurance payments. So as an example, you might say your will, you want to leave some money to a charity, you want to leave some money to your grandkids or whatever you want along those lines, which you can definitely do.
Yeah, okay. And I suppose...
I think also too, sorry, James, just on the binding death benefit nominations, I think the important thing is the state too is the nominations on that binding nomination has to either be a spouse or a financial dependent. So we often find situations where people who are single, they've got neither. So in that case, then obviously James's option of a legal representative would be the best and only option because they don't have a spouse or financial dependents to pass it on to.
Absolutely.
And I suppose, I mean, if I'm an expat and I die overseas and I haven't nominated a beneficiary or a binding nomination on my super insurance, what happens then? To the super balance, the life insurance cover? What's the process then?
It's actually up to the trustees then. So what the trustees will do is have a look at who can claim against your estate and then work out from there. So as an example, you might say, look, I would prefer all my funds to go to my family. So once again, Kayla to receive all the proceeds. But if I'm an expat, haven't nominated or haven't re-nominated the form because it only lasts for 3 years, it could be, once again, up to the trustees' discretion. So the trustees could say, once again, that yes, your funds should go to Kayla. However, let's say another family member of mine says, no, I deserve funds because I looked after him for that period of time. They could actually put a protest and actually appeal to the trustees or to the estate saying that, yes, they deserve funds as well. So once again, it's not certain to what you really want in the event of a claim versus having certainty by making sure that document is in place and it is still valid. So once again, with regarding your superannuation fund, make sure that it's valid and in place. Because most times I see people say, yes, I've nominated a person. It is binding, but it might have been done 5 years ago, which unfortunately is invalid.
Yep, 3-year rules up. Okay, well, right, that's quite clear. I'll move on to point 10 now. So returning to Australia. So what happens to my cover when I return to Australia? So I think a good example would just be a case study. I've gone through the process of getting a new insurance policy set up before I left. It was going to cover me for 4 years whilst I'm abroad. I've now come back. What do I do? Do I need to tell anyone? Do I need to do anything? Do I need to change anything?
Okay, first of all, when you're coming back to Australia, what you need to consider is how does a policy still reflect your wishes? So first of all, did you take on additional cover because you're an expat and because you were looking at taking on more risk over that overseas? Or once again, based on the country, did the insurance company load your actual policy because of the additional risk? So it's always worthwhile reviewing your cover to make sure it's still valid, as in still appropriate to your needs. So as an example, you've come back from overseas. Let's just pick on a country such as Indonesia. The insurance company decided that, yes, they're not going to load your policy because they see that as more high risk. When you come back to Australia, if you get in contact with the insurance company and say, yes, I'm back in Australia, I'm now classified as an Australian resident, the insurance company can then provide you with documentation to basically put you on standard rates rather than paying the additional loading for the additional policy. So once again, when you do return to Australia, it's the purpose of reviewing your policy to make sure that it still reflects your wishes as in the cover levels. And also, did you take on additional, did your premiums get affected by additional higher premiums because you're overseas as well?
Yeah, and I think that's a big one. A lot of individuals wouldn't be aware of that they're probably paying maybe an inflated premium because the insurance provider is taking on that additional risk. When they come home, they'll just let it tick over in the background, keep paying the premiums, whereas, you know, you look at the premiums over 10 years, they've paid, you know, an extra $5,000-$10,000 when they didn't need to. That's a very big point. And just this last one, if I'm planning on returning to Australia, should I purchase Australian cover or overseas cover? So should I purchase cover in my new country of residence or should I stick to purchasing cover in Australia?
Okay, so when we're looking at actual cover based on, first of all, in a good situation, let's say your health is quite healthy, you're healthy, there's nothing wrong with you at all, then the benefits of looking at Australian cover is, first off, structure-wise, you can look at superannuation to fund a portion of your cover. Also, different tax implications within Australia may be more beneficial than the policy that you hold overseas. And then finally, looking at the actual definitions, Australia does have fantastic definitions when it comes to insurance policies. So once again, looking at Australian-based cover compared to international cover, Australian cover does give you more benefits than proposed international companies. So should you look at purchasing cover? Well, it depends on your health, first of all. So if you're healthy, there's no health impacts on that, then yes, you could look at a proposed policy back in Australia and use certain benefits such as structure, tax and so forth. If you have health concerns, and don't cancel that policy. The reason why is you might come back into Australia and go, great, I've cancelled my cover with Aviva overseas and now want to apply for a company in Australia. Because of some health events, the Australian companies might say, no, we actually can't provide you with cover, and you shot yourself in the foot as you don't have cover anymore. So, yes, once again, case-by-case basis, Australia does give, once again, insurance policies to benefit the Australian community based on the individual needs, but also depends on your health history.
Yeah, okay. And I suppose one unique area that I've come across just when I've done my consults, especially with clients in that Gulf area, is those insurance bond products where I think you pay into it for a little while, and then usually you get a guaranteed amount that gets paid back to you, but I think it's a 10-year term or a 15-year term. Have you had any exposure to those or seen any of those before?
Definitely seen them before.
Yep.
Once again, it's more like a savings plan than an actual insurance policy. So it really depends on that individual policy itself. My best recommendations is to contact us and we can have a look at it and see if it's worthwhile holding.
Yep, okay. No, I mean, that's fine. That's all I've got to ask on those ones. Brett, any other questions coming from your side?
Look, there's a couple of questions coming up on the screen, but I thought it's a good opportunity just to let everyone know that what we're talking about today is specific to every individual person. So rather than sort of taking a live forum of questions, what I'd like to do is just direct everyone to the email addresses that are on the screen. The reason being is then we can actually assess each individual person's personal situation and provide obviously the best advice, because as Darko said, you know, when you're getting retail cover for life or TPD or trauma, your conditions, your exemptions, your exclusions will be completely different to that of another person. So I've just put up on the screen there each of our contact details there. So I encourage everyone who's on the call today and obviously watching the recording down the track. I'll just make a point too that this webinar will be going on to our podcast. So for those listening on the podcast, we will put those email addresses in the show notes below too. So you can get hold of either Darko or ourselves if you have any further questions. So and I'll also take the opportunity, you know, social media for us is a very, it's an amazing tool that we're able to educate expats around the world. And just put up on the screen here some of our channels on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. There's also LinkedIn as well and YouTube. Once again, for those on the podcast, I will put those links in the show notes below. So I'll just take this off the screen now, put us all back on the screens there. So Darko, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. It's an area that, you know, I think people give it the least amount of attention, and it has the largest ramifications if done incorrectly. So thanks very much for writing a few truths and dispelling a few myths there, because, you know, both James and I, and I'm sure you do too, see some absolute furfies come through the screen sometimes. And like James said, with some of these insurance bonds that are sold as insurance, in actual fact, it just means here's your money back if you die. So, you can have your money in this insurance bond or you can put it in your mattress and the same thing happens. You die, the money comes back to you. So you're just not paying absorbent fees along the way. So you're not lining someone else's pocket. So thank you so much for your time today. And as I said to Wayburn before, feel free to reach out to James, myself, or Darko if you have any questions. And the next webinar is going to be on the budget. So 2nd of April, we've got an early budget. On the 3rd of April at 10:30 a.m. Queensland time and 9:30 p.m. Queensland time, that's going to be a long day, we'll be running live webinars on that I'll also put the registration details in the both in the description below for those watching on the video, and also too in the show notes for those on the podcast. So, gentlemen, as always, it's been a pleasure, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you once again.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Take care.